Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Christopher Edley, the William H. Orrick Distinguished Chair and Dean of UC Berkeley School of Law. I'd like to extend a warm welcome to all of you at the first conference on the Supreme Court of California. I cannot tell you how pleased I am to open this conference, a product of the joint effort of the court and of the law school. It's my belief that as the state's leading public law school and a part of the flagship campus of the University of California system, we at Bolt Hall have a special obligation to promote public understanding of the work of the court. The Supreme Court of California heads the largest judicial system in the world. It handles the most cases of any court in the United States, and according to citation studies, is the most influential state Supreme Court in the nation. It interprets the law for a state that has the seventh largest economy in the world and governs one out of every seven citizens of the United States. The chief, on occasion, talks about the burdens of the system, but I was at a conference a few weeks ago and heard a little bit about the court system in India. And the trial court system in India is in such terrible shape, burdened with such terrible backlogs, that if they accepted no civil cases from now going forward, it would take over 200 years to clear the backlog. So, to members of the court, I simply say, things could be worse. This conference is not just a project of the law school and the court, but a collaboration of the academy, bench, and bar. I'm looking forward to the dinner speech of the Chief Justice, and I thank him for his leadership. I also want to welcome Berkeley alumni Jeffrey Bleich, the outgoing president of the State Bar Association and a partner at Munger Tolles, and Holly Fougier, the new president of the State Bar Association. Both alums, let me repeat that, both alums of... But I'd like to offer a special welcome to former mayor, former senator, former governor, but still Bolt Hall class of 62, the Honorable Pete Wilson. This conference is the first element of an initiative by Berkeley to expand study of the California Constitution and of our Supreme Court. And this initiative will in turn take place within a broader endeavor, a multidisciplinary think tank based at the law school, addressing issues of law and public governance with particular emphasis on California. Let me give you an idea of the exciting things we have in mind related to our great court. This fall, we added to our regular curricular offerings a special seminar on the California Constitution and the court. I'm pleased to say that the course was fully subscribed and that several of the students are working on scholarly papers on the court's role, the court's work. The law school and the California Law Review will cooperate to produce a year in review issue studying the court's term. Two leading scholars, William Eskridge of Yale Law School and Erwin Chemerinsky, the dean of the new UC Irvine Law School, will be writing a foreword on the court's current term and an essay on the marriage cases, respectively. They will be joined by several student notes on individual cases. I would like to thank Jose Lopez, the editor-in-chief of the California Law Review, for his leadership in establishing what we hope will become a regular feature of the California Law Review. Another aspect of our initiative, I'm pleased to say, is that the court has agreed to hold a sitting here at Bolt in November of 2010. We will make sure that this wonderful event will be open not just to the members of the campus community, but also to students at local secondary schools. Perhaps the most interesting plan for further collaboration will be a moot court for litigants scheduled to appear before the court. One issue that the justices have pressed upon us is the need to improve oral advocacy before the court. Now, Golden Gate, I understand, has been doing some moots for some of the arguments before the court, but the one at Bolt will be, how do I say this, much, much better, because we are going to supply the participants with an unlimited supply of chocolate-covered strawberries. We plan to open a moot court at Berkeley that will help litigants develop their arguments, and ultimately, we hope to provide a focal point for an appellate bar that specializes on the work of the California Supreme Court. We hope that many of you here will return in the near future as advocates or judges in our moot court. Planning for this conference began almost a year ago, when my colleagues and I had an opportunity to visit with Chief Justice Ron George, Justice Kay Werdiger, and the Chief's staff. I would like to thank the faculty members who have worked so hard to plan the panels, Steve Bundy, Rick Frank, Jeff Selbin, Chuck Weisselberg, and especially John Yu and my predecessor as dean, Jesse Choper. I'd like to give special recognition to Dana Gandhi in the dean's office and others in the dean's office staff for all the administrative support for the conference. Without them, obviously, we could never have events like this one. And now I'd like to welcome Jeff Bleich to the podium for not just some words of welcome, but some reflections based on his experience as an advocate before the court. I am looking forward to an exciting day full of interesting ideas, arguments, conversation, and direction for our future together, exploring and advancing the great work of the Supreme Court of California. Thank you all for coming.
Well, thank you, Dean Edley, and I'd like to thank the University of California Berkeley School of Law, which is what we have to say now instead of just Bolt Hall, for inviting me here today. This is, of course, this is an opportunity that any person who's had the chance to appear before the Supreme Court dreams about. It may be my only chance to address the members of the California Supreme Court without being interrupted. Or losing. Even the most seasoned appellate advocates know that appearing before the California Supreme Court is tough. And it's similar to what Justice Robert Jackson used to say about appearing before the U.S. Supreme Court when he was the Solicitor General. He said that he made three arguments in every case. The first came the logical, coherent, complete argument that he practiced in front of the mirror. Second was the incoherent, interrupted, and embarrassing argument that he made to the court. And the third was the brilliant, devastating argument that occurred to him on the drive home afterward. Unfortunately for the members of the court, you only get to see that second argument from us. So in the few minutes that I have today, I want to talk about the state of advocacy before the Supreme Court, and be provocative enough to wake people up at 9 o'clock in the morning and offer two suggestions for possibly improving the quality of advocacy. I think it's a given that the best courts want the best arguments. Good, careful advocacy strengthens the decision-making process because it ensures that the justices get perspectives that they might otherwise miss. And that, in turn, means that there's less of a chance of a mistake. But it also means that they write with greater confidence and with in a more persuasive way, all of which increases people's faith in the justice system. So the better the advocacy, the better the system works. When I was a clerk, I got to see the differences among advocates firsthand at the U.S. Supreme Court. And some advocates had, over time, earned the trust and respect of the justices so that when they were questioned really as a colleague who was trying to help the court work through a problem. On the other hand, there were advocates who weren't prepared or who distorted the record or who just were so unused to being there, they were too nervous to really think straight. And my favorite of these is a lawyer who from New York who kept calling Justice Scalia that guy. As in, yeah, that's a question that guy kept asking me, yeah. And in those cases, what generally happens is the court just stops asking questions altogether. and misses out on that opportunity for further reflection. So my experience is that although the California Supreme Court has really been blessed with some superb advocates, many of whom are in this room, my impression is that the core group of high-quality advocates who repeatedly appear before this court is smaller than it could be. And sitting either in on oral argument or watching it on the California TV station, I'm one of their few viewers, I think, I've seen some very ordinary argument. In fact, after watching a morning of argument about a year ago, I sent an email to attorneys at my firm with what I called the secret list of top 10 tricks to outperform your adversary in oral argument before the California Supreme Court. And so I thought I would make it less secret now and tell you the top 10 list. The number one, show up on time. Number two, wait your turn. Don't speak or make annoying noises into the microphone while the other side is speaking. Number three was don't speak while a justice is speaking. And number four is don't speak after your time is up. And number five was don't respond to a question by telling the court that you already answered that one. Not to worry, because you're getting there. Or my favorite, which was, yes, but so what? Don't check your watch. That was number six. Number seven, don't start your argument by reading your brief aloud, or end your argument by reading your brief aloud, or ever, ever read your brief aloud, ever. Don't make stuff up. Don't ignore stuff that matters. And don't, during an actual oral argument, use the word stuff. Those were my 10 rules. There's no doubt, as Dean Edley said, that the California Supreme Court is the leading state appellate court in the land. But I think as that list of things that, you know, and those are all true, that I'd observed from the court suggests that we are not, as a state, the bench is exceeding the bar, and the bar has some room to measure up to the quality of the bench. And I'm not just saying that to suck up to the justices. As Dean Edley mentioned, there was a study published by the Davis Law Review earlier this year that concluded that our court is the most influential court in the country just based on the number of times that decisions of the California Supreme Court were followed by other states. Many of you are probably already aware of this study, but in 65 years prior to 2005, California led all states with 1,260 decisions that had been followed by other courts. To give you some context, New York is only about half as influential as California, with about 627 followed cases. So while the California Supreme Court stands at the pinnacle of courts, I'm not sure, based on what I've seen, that that we've done enough as we should as a state bar to measure up to that same standard. And I think there are two things that we could do to improve the quality of advocacy by the bar. First, California currently doesn't have its Solicitor General's office organized to create a team of advocates who are trained to represent the state before the high court. And second, as Dean Edley mentioned, there is no real clinic out there yet that is dedicated to help identify good cases for Supreme Court review and providing resources to make sure that those cases are properly presented to the court. And both of these, I think, could help the court find good cases and make sure that the cases are argued well. And I'll just speak briefly about each of those two. First, about the Solicitor General's office, about 29 states have their own SGs, which is nearly four times as many as there were less than two decades ago. And the reason that they're increasing in popularity is because they work. It tends to produce better advocates for the state in high-stakes cases. Now, although California has an SG, the office largely functions like the old systems were in states that don't have SGs, which is that you have a section chief who specializes in state and federal appeals, but the cases are actually argued by the trial lawyers, the DAs, who handle the case below. We haven't formed a small trained core of lawyers who are familiar with the court, its practices, its procedures, and who are used to arguing and who develop that reputation for honesty and integrity with the court. A model that's more like the U.S. Solicitor General's office, in my view, would increase the professionalism and the quality of the work. And that's not a knock on the trial lawyers in state government. It's just that the skills that you need to be a good trial lawyer don't necessarily translate to good appellate work. I think the line people always use is that a trial is a search for the truth and an appeal is a search for error. And a core of appellate advocates ensure that you have temperaments that are better suited to that and trained for this more scholarly analysis. Over time, the advantage is that this group tends to become sort of the cradle for a appellate diaspora, because the people leave the Solicitor General's office, they go to private practice, and they bring those lessons with them, and they train their own core, and it generally results in a better, more professional bar. The second thing I want to mention that Dean Edley touched on briefly was this idea for a clinic at Bolt Hall. Many schools already have models like that for the U.S. Supreme Court, and these clinics search for cases that would meet the court's criteria for review. Here it would normally be cases where there are conflicts among the lower courts in California, where the litigants and citizens and the courts need some guidance. And a clinic would look for those cases, look for those conflicts, identify the cases that are best presented for this, the cleanest records, and then could be presented to the court. And with the court getting about 10,000 petitions a year, they can never see which is the best case that may come in. They can't see around the corner, whereas a clinic could do that sort of study. And the court wouldn't be so much at the mercy of the ad hoc decisions of individuals to bring cases before it. Ideally, this would help them in evaluating cases and framing the facts more effectively. And that's where I think Berkeley comes in. As Dean Edley mentioned, Golden Gate already does this, but we could do it better in terms of our moot courts. We would have more moot courts. We would have professionally trained practitioners and professors working on the briefs. There would be more opportunity to review petitions. And finally, there would be lots of practice rounds of argument as opposed to the one practice round that you get with Golden Gate University. The success of this can be measured by what Stanford has done with their clinic, which they set up 3 or 4 years ago at the U.S. Supreme Court. In the first 4 months of the last term, 6 of the argued cases before the U.S. Supreme Court came from the Stanford clinic, and this year they have 6 more cases that are before the court. So it does work, and it is a benefit to the court. I mentioned, as I said, the idea to Dean Edley, and Dean Edley said he likes the idea, and he hopes that alums, especially wealthy ones, do too. So in short, I will end my remarks by saying there really has been no greater privilege in my professional career than having the opportunity to appear before the California Supreme Court. And at the risk of losing out on future opportunities to better lawyers, I'd like to see us take up both of these challenges and work to make a Supreme Court bar that measures up to the quality of our Supreme Court bench. So those are my ideas for it. Now I have the great honor of introducing Holly Fujie. Holly is, as Dean Edley mentioned, the new president of the state bar. So she has experience already at cleaning up all the things that I've messed up in my time preceding her. She's an outstanding lawyer, an outstanding advocate, and a great friend. Holly Fujie.
Now, see, that's just like Jeff. Jeff emailed me last week, and he said, yeah, you know, I'm going to throw together a few remarks. It's, maybe the night before. It's not going to be anything. And he has this, reasoned, cogent, and coherent speech about plans he has. He drives me crazy. I'm always following him. He's so terrific. So I'm going to start off, actually, with a story, my favorite story of appearing in appellate court, which was in the Ninth Circuit, where I was watching, luckily, my opposing counsel, and he was arguing. He was from the East Coast, and he kept referring to the judges. He would say, "Well, judge this. Well, judge, yes, I think that's a good idea. Judge, please do this." And finally, Judge Stephen Trott interrupted him and said, "Well, excuse me, you shouldn't say judge. Just you may say Judge Trott. You may say Your Honor, but don't say just judge." And he was so nervous. He said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, Judge." Anyway, it's a tremendous pleasure to be back here at Berkeley for the law school's first conference on the Supreme Court of California. The court that we are meeting today is radically different, radical being a word fondly associated with this campus by my fellow alums from the 1970s, from the court sitting at the time I graduated from Bolt Hall, back when it was Bolt Hall. Since that time, it's experienced 100% turnover from a combination of retirement and electoral defeat. And it's been variously been accused of being too radical and too reactionary, too activist and too reluctant to act, and usually in the same term. So, but I will say this for the California Supreme Court, it is never boring. As a lawyer, therefore, I welcome the opportunity to hear in the justices' own words how they perceive where the court has been, where it is today, and where it will be in the future. Like many other California lawyers, I have on more than one occasion tried to predict the way in which the court would rule on a given issue and advise my clients that way. And knowing more about how the court thinks can only help us in these interesting and often wildly speculative exercises. Because we read your opinions, we read your biographies, we read your speeches, if we can get to the trash at the Supreme Court, we'd read your tea leaves. So, anything that we can get directly from you is very important. The relationship between lawyers and the judiciary is a complex one. You know, all judges used to be lawyers, and yet lawyers sometimes wonder if the judiciary remembers what it was like to practice law. My friends who are judges, on the other hand, sometimes ask if lawyers understand the processes that go into decisions when lawyers are condemning a judge for excessive restraint or for judicial activism, both terms for any non-lawyers out there that really mean the judge ruled against my position. So this conference is extremely valuable to the legal community because it brings together the bar and the state's highest court, which is, of course, the final arbiter on the meaning of the California Constitution, not including, of course, the California electorate, which can and often does, of course, attempt to change that Constitution. I was just picked up at the airport, as a matter of fact, the book The Nine, which is the subtitle is Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, and I thought that was appropriate. And this is what I think any practitioners who are out there are hoping to get is inside sort of the secret world of how it is that decisions are made. And this conference is of particular interest this year when the roles of both the California Supreme Court and the electorate have been under such intense national scrutiny. And I'm referring, of course, to the court's rulings in the marriage cases, which have raised so much controversy and which have now resulted in a vote to change. Note that I do not say either amend or revise the California Constitution. Perhaps never has a decision by the court been so eagerly awaited, whether with hope or with trepidation. And that decision has certainly been one of the most discussed and analyzed in history. As in the 1941 California Supreme Court decision of Perez versus Sharp, which was the first in this country to strike down anti-miscegenation laws, the marriage cases were decided in a California that was deeply divided as to the propriety and morality of the marriages whose validity was being questioned by the litigants. Whether or not you agree with that decision, I think it is clear that it's resulted in a historic chain of events in California. Understanding that decision and the court that made it will ever remain part of the analysis that will be performed by California law scholars for years to come, regardless of the ultimate fate of same-sex marriage in this country. We're fortunate to have the court here to discuss the cases decided this term and to provide California lawyers, as well as legal scholars, with vital insight into the workings of this very hardworking and thoughtful court. On behalf of myself and the State Bar of California, I thank the Supreme Court and all the speakers for providing this invaluable information to the legal community and for sharing their thoughts on one of the most important elements of the California justice system today. But I also have the honor of introducing Governor Pete Wilson. Of course, everybody knows the governor from his years of over 30 years of public service, governor of California, U.S. Senator, mayor of San Diego. And his experience is particularly relevant these days, I think, because, as it says in his biography, he is credited with leading California from the depths of recession to prosperous economic recovery. We need you, Governor Wilson, right now. And in his normal practice of being on the cutting edge of dealing with difficult financial times, he's also now in the most difficult financial times. The place to be is in private practice, and that's where he is. He is now of counsel to the McCutcheon firm. So now I'd like to introduce Governor Wilson.
Well, thank you very much, Holly. Mr. Chief Justice, distinguished members of the California Supreme Court, distinguished guests. Actually, Holly's comments brought to mind a couple of things. I would be remiss if I didn't say that as I was listening to Jeff recite all of the statistics that confirm California's place, the Supreme Court's case, as the distinguished leading appellate court in the land, and mentioned all the times which California Supreme Court decisions have been used by the U.S. Supreme Court and by other courts throughout the land, one thing did stick in my mind. You'll understand why. It relates to something that Holly said. There was a New York surrogate court case from the 1880s, and I don't have this verbatim, but essentially the frustrated judge in that case uttered this declaration: "No man's life, liberty, or property is safe while the legislature is in session." And as far as the kind comment that Holly made, I'd be happy to resume the chair that I left, which brought to mind something else. John Davies, also a classmate, as is Justice Werdegar, took a great deal of time and effort, both when I was in the Senate and when I was governor. We spent hours and hours. He spent far more hours than I, but I was the beneficiary of his research, his vetting. We took very seriously the appointment of judges, first recommendations to the president as to federal judges. And then, of course, when I was governor, I had the appointing power myself. And we spent an inordinate amount of time, I think it seemed to the rest of my staff, working on the problem of judicial selection. And I think it was well worth the time because of the importance that I place on that. And in fact, once years ago, when debating my friend Jerry Brown, as we were running against one another for the United States Senate, I said somewhat unkindly to him, I said, "Jerry, long after you are a dim, unpleasant recollection, your judges will be your legacy." And that is true of every governor. And those of us who do take it seriously, I think, are well advised to do so. However, coming back to Holly's point about being in the chair at a time of challenge, that being the case now, and it was the case in the early 90s, shortly after I took office, the California Supreme Court was confronted with a decision, and the decision related to interpreting the initiative that the people had passed imposing term limits, not just upon the legislature, but upon the executive branch as well. And, of course, I'm delighted to have the opportunity this morning to address, if not the entire court, at least most of it. And I have a special feeling about this court because, with the exception of Justices Baxter and Kennard, I've had the privilege of appointing all the other members of the court, either directly to the Supreme Court or at least got them on their way there. And thinking back to the decision that they made on the question of whether or not the initiative imposed a lifetime ban upon those once they had left the office after two terms, the court held, I thought quite gratuitously, that it did impose a lifetime ban. So I've been waiting to tell them something. And it's simply this: you ungrateful bastards. I was going to just sit down after I said that. I remember when I was an entering freshman at Bold Hall, now Berkeley Law School. I remember that I think it was Frank Newman, later dean of Bold, later a member of this distinguished Supreme Court of California, was teaching a course to freshmen, and he was trying to impart to them for the first time the concept of stare decisis, the idea that precedent should govern the outcome of a trial based upon a prior ruling. And the concept was, let us say, hard for some of my fellow students to grasp, or at least to accept. And they really couldn't quite accept the idea that a ruling from a prior suit should define the result when, in fact, it was applied to the facts of a later case, if that produced what, in their judgment, was, quote, not the right result. They were focused on the result. And when Professor Newman asked all of us, what is the duty of a judge? Is it to apply the law to the facts of the case and to follow the precedent of the California Supreme Court or the clear legislative history of a statute enacted by the state legislature, or is it to do and to lead to a result that is, quote, the right thing? Well, fully a quarter of the freshmen in that classroom bellowed forth to do the right thing. And he then, with a smile for which he became famous, said to them, well, even if the Supreme Court has ruled otherwise, and fully a quarter bellowed yes, and were duly noted as possible future candidates for the Ninth Circuit. It seemed clear to him, and even to me, that they had not yet grasped the importance of the rule of law. And frankly, I think in the concentration upon being professionals, today too many Americans also, even lawyers who have been trained to value the rule of law, take it for granted, just as we take for granted the personal freedom that we enjoy as a result of the rule of law. Now, what has occupied a great many people, rightly so, in their concern to maintain a quality judiciary is to maintain, to safeguard the independence of the judiciary. In California, judges of our state courts are appointed by the governor for a term fixed by law. To retain their seats thereafter, they must face re-election. And it is on these judicial elections that increasingly money and political pressures have focused, presenting what many think, and I think, to be a growing threat to the independence of our state judiciary. California's system balances, or seeks to balance, the desirable vetting of qualified and impartial appointed judges with the accountability of judicial elections. Federal judges do not face the voters to retain their seats. Once appointed by the president and confirmed by the United States Senate, they enjoy life tenure unless they are removed for cause. Now, in creating the federal court system, those who did so conferred upon judges this job security to achieve judicial independence, which they and most other nations at the time and perhaps still feel threatened by popular election. Well, whatever the merit of that position, the federal system is far from perfect. In contrast to the timely decision of cases required in the California state courts Important questions can languish unresolved for years in federal courts, and they have here in California. Initiative measures have gone for years without disposition. Whatever their transgressions, federal judges are simply not accountable to voters who can remove them from office. And what this immunity from voter resentment offers in the way of independence, it lacks in accountability. It is not a perfect system. I personally do not think that judicial decisions should be immune from criticism, and I'm sure that you don't either. But that's not really the question. It is important that voters, however critical they might be of a particular decision, understand and fully really appreciate that their focus should not be on the result reached, but rather on how it was reached. And the test should be whether the result was the conclusion dictated by the court's correct application of the law. And if so, then the court cannot be fairly criticized if the judge or judges have followed the governing precedent, however much we may disagree with the result as policy. Policy decisions are the province of the legislature and the chief executive in this state, not the courts. The role and the duty of judges is to construe and to apply the law, and not to legislate. And if a judge personally disagrees strongly with the policy embodied in a statute that he or she thinks unwise, then unless they are able to find a constitutional flaw that requires that it be struck down, the judge's duty as a strict constructionist is to apply the law as the legislature has written it or as the Supreme Court has defined it, even though doing so compels a result that is repugnant personally to him or her. But it's wrong and grossly unfair to pillory such a strict constructionist judge who has reached that repugnant result by performing his or her duty faithfully adhering to the doctrine of stare decisis, which was so difficult for so many of those freshmen those years ago. Criticism of the judicial activism, in quotes, that occurs when a judge chooses to follow his or her policy preference rather than legal precedent is fully justified. But special interest advocates who focus on the result typically wrongly applaud judicial activism that reaches the result they want as a matter of policy. Activism that ignores the law to reach a result that is either politically liberal or politically conservative is to be condemned as what it is, politicizing and undermining the rule of law. Now, judicial elections are a concern to many. Jess Choper will be leading a panel this afternoon in which three distinguished judges from out of California, from other states, will share their concerns and experience. I recently made a suggestion to Justice Chin's commission appointed by the Chief Justice to focus on this problem and suggested that the precedent that has been created by the case, the Republican Party of Minnesota versus White, that essentially imposed involuntarily a duty to follow one's First Amendment rights as a candidate for judicial office, can't be struck down, but it could in fact be dealt with in a way that struck me as novel. I don't know whether it'll be practical. But it seemed to me that there is no point either in contesting that specific holding or the one that followed in the Weaver case. But what perhaps might be done is a little public education following or in the course of a campaign to amend the California State Constitution to provide a message to judicial candidates and to all the world so that when they receive these questionnaires demanding their position on things that may in fact come before them. Once they assume the bench or continue on the bench, they should be protected. More importantly, the rule of law and judicial independence should be protected by a box on the outside of the questionnaire, on the envelope, and on the questionnaire itself that says, judicial candidates are urged by Article blank of Section blank of the Constitution of the State of California to conscientiously forbear from exercising their right of free speech by refraining from answering any question put to them in any forum or medium or public forum which seeks to elicit from them views or commitments which could undermine the fairness and impartiality of the courts of this state or require from them a recusal in future. I don't know whether that would work, but the idea, obviously, is to say, yes, you have a right under the First Amendment that is inviolable, but it does not compel you to exercise it, and you cannot be held culpable for failing to do so when, in fact, the consequences would impair your ability to do your job as a judge. Well, if we cannot overstate the importance of protecting judicial independence, then I would say that there is also an accompanying requirement for strict constructionism, and I will best put it this way. I don't think that we can overstate the importance of judicial restraint, which I would define in the following fashion. Judges should not violate the doctrine of separation of powers. Here you will hear from a chief executive, a former one, with an axe to grind. They should not go beyond their very important role as judges and encroach on either legislative or executive responsibilities. The Founding Fathers gave us a doctrine of separation of powers for a very good reason. It is part of the system of checks and balances. It is part of their philosophy that certain functions should be assigned as responsibilities of the distinct branches of government for very good reason. And I think they did an extraordinary job. And in fact, the Constitution seems to be holding up reasonably well after a couple of centuries. Judges should monitor and prevent the legislative branch from seeking to usurp the authority and powers of the executive. And judges should monitor and prevent the executive from exercising or from exceeding its authority in the exercise of powers granted by law and by the Constitution, and definitely limited by them. It is the genius, I think, of the constitutional doctrine of separation of powers that has worked so well, but there is an increasing tendency, I find, for people to ignore it, to push the envelope, and in fact, really to violate it. That is not a healthy thing, and I think to the extent that judges are themselves guilty of it, they invite the kind of criticism that is justified and in danger, the sort of violation of their independence that I hope and think that all in this room agree is an essential ingredient to maintaining the rule of law. Now, having said that and having mentioned John Davies, Kay's classmate and mine, who has had a very distinguished career, served two terms as the chair of the Board of Regents of the University of California, did an exceptional job there, but I hearken back to the many hours over the many years that he has served in being the judicial appointment secretary, not only to me, but really to many, many others. I would say if he were here, I'll say that even though he is not here, that I think probably he has had a greater impact on the quality of the judiciary in North America than any other single individual now living, for the reason that Jeff indicated. We've got more judges than anybody else. And we have had the privilege of appointing a great many of them. I will simply say that Bold, or Berkeley Law School, is to be commended for having this, as Holly termed it, first conference on the important jurisprudence of the most important appellate court in the land. Its impact is and will continue to be enormous. I am proud of the court. I am proud of Berkeley Law School for holding this. If it's not an annual event, I hope that at least it will be the inauguration of ongoing close attention of the kind that's already been described, because it warrants it. This court has an enormous importance, enormous responsibility, and in Jeff's expression of his ambition that the Supreme Court bench bar be up to the quality of the bench, I commend you, sir. I think that is an admirable ambition. And looking at the rest of the program, I see that it is an extraordinary program and that you are in for a very important and, I would think, pleasurable day. You can argue like hell at any one of the upcoming panels. But I will close, as I should, with what may seem to you sort of out of context. And that is something that has to do with market research. Here I'm talking about the independence of judges, their duty to abide by the law. Certainly they shouldn't be influenced by polls, all true. However, in Jeff's remarks about brevity, I couldn't help being reminded of this important market research done by a leading university. It goes to what occurs when a speaker, the average speaker, continues his remarks past 30 minutes. And it seems that what occurs is that the audience divides into three groups. Let's say 20% listen attentively, more or less, and they're able to give back pretty much what they've heard. The next 20% drift a bit. They think about lunch, the next break, a drink. The remaining 60%, it seems, are actively engaged in sexual fantasy. And I was gratified to learn this. Nice for me to realize that I've given so much pleasure to so many people over these years. In any way, my congratulations to the court and to Bolt or to Berkeley Law School. I think that this attention is well deserved, and I look forward to its continuing, and I am privileged and honored to be here to keynote the very first one. Thank you.
I want to say that it's a real pleasure to be back at my alma mater for this inaugural conference on the California Supreme Court. My colleagues and I are delighted that Bolt Berkeley Law has chosen to hold a conference on the Supreme Court of California. And we are grateful to Dean Edley and the many faculty members whose efforts brought this idea to fruition. I feel particularly honored to launch the conference this morning with our first panel. Now, in the next hour and a half, our very distinguished panel will conduct a review of the California Supreme Court's 2007-2008 term. In this term, we decided 107 cases. You're not going to hear about all of them. Of the 107, they have chosen six to discuss. These six touch on California's constitutional right to freedom of speech in the context of a private shopping mall, the enforceability in California of pre-employment non-competition agreements, the impact of Proposition 218 on the authority of local governments to impose property assessments, an attorney's ethical duty upon inadvertently coming across the work product of opposing counsel. The pre-proposition 8, right of gays and lesbians to marry. And finally, whether a physician can refuse on religious grounds to administer fertility treatments to a lesbian. Now we'll see if our panelists, am I not being heard? We'll see if our panelists find, as Governor Wilson admonished, that these decisions were dictated by the rule of law. It's now my pleasure to introduce our very distinguished panel, and I'm going to do so in alphabetical order. Victoria DeGoff is a partner in the civil appellate firm of DeGoff and Sherman. A Bolt graduate and a member of the Order of the Coif, Ms. DeGoff has handled hundreds of appeals throughout the state. She has written and lectured extensively on appellate matters. She is a former president of the California Academy of Appellate Lawyers and a member of the very selective American Academy of Appellate Lawyers. At the behest of three different Chief Justices of California, Vicki has lent her expertise to numerous appellate-related committees, and she also serves on several law and social justice-related boards. Dean Kenneth Starr is Dwayne and Kelly Roberts Dean and Professor of Law at Pepperdine University School of Law. Dean Starr clerked for Supreme Court, for Chief Justice Warren Burger of the United States Supreme Court, and served as a judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. He formerly served as Solicitor General of the United States. While in private practice, Dean Starr was a partner at Kirkland & Ellis and Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher. Professor Gerald Ullman is a professor of law at Santa Clara University and director of the university's Edwin A. Heafy Jr. Center for Trial and Appellate Advocacy. A former dean of Santa Clara Law School, Professor Ullman specializes in criminal law. He has served in the United States Attorney's Office prosecuting organized crime cases and has participated on the defense side in several high-profile trials, including the Daniel Ellsberg trial and the Pentagon Papers case, and O.J. Simpson. Our format this morning is that each panel member will discuss a case, after which the other two panel members will briefly comment, and we'll then move on to the next case. After all the cases have been covered, we're going to open discussion to questions from the audience. Now, in your folders are cards that you may use to write out your questions, and you may direct your question to a particular member of the panel or to the panel in general. And the cards are going to be collected intermittently throughout our discussion, and then as we close with the so-called marriage cases, we will finally collect the cards for questions. Now, Professor Ullman is going to start us off with the case of Fashion Valley Mall versus National Labor Relations Board. Thank you.
Thank you. First thing I want to do is correct the record. The first ever conference on the work of the California Supreme Court was convened at Santa Clara Law School in 1987. And this is something we should do more frequently than every 20 years. Since 1987, I've been keeping track on an annual basis of dissent and disagreement rates, watching the coming and going on the court. And the decision I'm going to discuss really gets us to the issue of stare decisis, because I've really been impressed over that 20-year period how rarely this court will overrule its prior precedents. There is a real commitment, I think, to stare decisis on the court. And I think it's worth noting that we are in a period of remarkable stability with the California Supreme Court. The average longevity of a justice on the California Supreme Court for its entire history is 11.3 years. We now have five justices on the court who have exceeded that average longevity. including Justice Kennard celebrating 19 years on the court, Justice Baxter 17 years, Chief Justice George 17 years, Justice Werdiger 14 years, and Justice Chin 12 years. So we have a remarkably stable court. My current writing project is to co-author a biography of Justice Stanley Mosk. And Stanley Mosk, as you know, was a lifelong champion of the independence of the California state constitution. Apart from the Bakke decision, I don't believe there was any decision in which he participated in which he took greater pride than Robbins versus Pruneyard Shopping Center. He didn't author the Pruneyard opinion. It was written by Justice Frank Newman. But it was a total vindication of a very powerful dissent that Justice Mosk had authored in the second Diamond decision, which Pruneyard overruled 5 years later. Now, I've lived in San Jose now for 22 years, and I can't drive past the Pruneyard Shopping Center without saluting. The Pruneyard case is kind of a local legend, which involved many of our leading lawyers in San Jose. The case arose when a group of Jewish high school students participating in a bar mitzvah project at the Temple Emmanuel sought to gather signatures on a petition to oppose a UN resolution against Zionism. And they took their petition downtown and discovered that the sidewalks of downtown San Jose were empty. So they headed for the new shopping center at the Pruneyard, which was attracting thousands of shoppers. And the security guards at the shopping center informed the boys that the shopping center was private property, and the soliciting of signatures for their petition was forbidden by the owners. The position of the shopping center owners was supported by recent decisions of the United States Supreme Court. But relying on the independent protection of the right of free speech under the state constitution, a lawsuit was filed on behalf of the boys and ultimately taken to the California Supreme Court by Phil Hammer, a 1962 Bold Hall graduate and a member of the Temple Emmanuel congregation. It was not a new issue for the court back then. In 1970, in Diamond versus Bland, a 6-1 decision authored by Justice Mosk, the court had declared that the First Amendment of the United States Constitution protected those soliciting signatures for an initiative measure at a private shopping center, even though this activity was not related to the business of the shopping center. 2 years later, in Lloyd Corporation versus Tanner, the U.S. Supreme Court took a different view of the First Amendment. And Diamond versus Bland then came back before the California Supreme Court. And in Diamond 2, by a 4-3 margin, the court concluded that Diamond 1 must be overruled. Justice Mosk's dissent in that case made a passionate argument for the independence of the state constitution. And 5 years later, two of the justices in the Diamond 2 majority were gone, and a new majority joined in overruling Diamond 2 to hold that the state constitution did protect the boys' First Amendment rights, even in privately owned shopping centers. Now, this term in Fashion Valley Mall versus NLRB, our current court revisited this issue on a certified question from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Did a San Diego shopping center violate the National Labor Relations Act by prohibiting a labor union from using the premises to urge a boycott of one of the stores in the shopping mall because that store advertised in the local newspaper with which the union was having a labor dispute? In a 4-3 decision authored by Justice Carlos Moreno, the court reaffirmed the Pruneyard ruling that a shopping mall is a public forum and that a rule prohibiting speech that advocates a boycott is content-based and subject to strict scrutiny under the California Constitution. But what I found most fascinating about Fashion Valley Mall was the dissent authored by Justice Ming Chin. He argues that Pruneyard was wrong when it was decided, and has been overwhelmingly rejected by other state Supreme Courts. He concludes that we should no longer ignore this tide of history and should join the judicial mainstream by overruling Prunyard. I found two arguments in the dissent relating to stare decisis somewhat disconcerting. First was the argument that Prunyard was less deserving of adherence because that decision itself overruled a prior precedent that was only 5 years old, did so by a vote of 4-3, and was attributable to a change of composition on the court. While all these facts are true, their recital makes me nervous. Should a precedent be more vulnerable because it was decided by a divided court, or because it itself overruled a prior precedent? Think of all the precedents that we continue to follow that suffer from the same disabilities identified by Justice Chin. Miranda versus Arizona, for example, overruled a prior precedent that was 2 years old, did so by a 5-4 margin, and was attributable to a change of composition on the court. Yet in Dickerson versus the United States, Chief Justice Rehnquist declined the opportunity to overrule it, declaring, "While we have overruled prior decisions when subsequent cases have undermined their doctrinal underpinnings, we do not believe this happened in the Miranda decision." Well, as Justice Moreno points out in his majority opinion, subsequent California cases had strengthened the doctrinal underpinning of Prunyard, not undermined it. And the appropriate place to look was how the precedent had been subsequently treated in the California courts. Second, Justice Chin looks elsewhere than California to see how Prunyard has fared, and clearly it has not fared well. Apparently, the court is justifiably proud of how frequently its precedents are respected and followed by other state Supreme Courts. And the recent study by Jake Deere demonstrates that the California Supreme Court leads every other state Supreme Court by a substantial margin in the number of times its precedents are followed and fully justifies the pride of the court. But I would hate to see the nose counting of other states become the standard by which we assess whether a particular precedent should be overruled. It seems to me that we would undercut the whole principle of independence of our state constitution. It is not only independent of the United States Constitution, but it is equally independent of every other state constitution. The doctrinal underpinning of Prunyard is a simple reality that shopping malls have replaced public sidewalks as forums that provide access to the public. If anything has changed since Prunyard, at least in California, it's that shopping malls have totally taken over. In San Jose, the shoppers who once filled the Prunyard now fill Santana Row, six city blocks that are privately owned. And I'm delighted that the court has continued to uphold the Prunyard precedent that those six blocks remain a public forum, even though they are privately owned.
Thank you, Jerry. Would one of my panelists like to comment further? Vicki, perhaps?
I'd just like to pick up very briefly on two themes that Jerry mentioned. And one of them has to do, they both actually have to do with tensions between ways of looking at issues. And the first has to do with government functions versus private rights. And we have all been witness to what can happen when government turns over governmental functions to private parties. The less privileged in society end up having to depend on what Tennessee Williams called the kindness of strangers. And this does not always happen as much as we would like it to. So one of the most important reasons, and I'm pretty sure I learned this in high school civics and maybe even back, they taught it back in grammar school, that one of the most important reasons for having a judiciary is to protect the minority from the tyranny of the majority. And so in terms of weighing what other state courts have done, sometimes the California Supreme Court can be, in state court relationships, a kind of microcosm of that, so that it falls to the California Supreme Court or other individual state courts to protect the citizens of their state against what one might call the tyranny of a majority of the states.
Ken, would you like to add something?
Two brief points. One on stare decisis. I think everyone in the room understands that it is an ultimate judgment call. When a judge is called upon, to the best of his or her ability, to interpret the Constitution, that is a very weighty matter. When you're called upon, having taken the oath of office, to interpret the Constitution, and so I think it does suggest this attitude of humility, of looking at the wisdom of what has gone before. And the fact, quite frankly, and here I part with Jerry's observation, that the original decision was a deeply divided one, should perhaps cause everyone to be humble in assessing the continuing correctness. It also suggests to me the wisdom of looking, not in a nose-counting way, but simply to look at the wisdom of the critiques that have flowed. And if one is convinced by the wisdom of the critiques that have flowed from other courts across the land, then to say, I greatly respect the judgment of those who went before, but I respectfully have my own obligation. Justice Chen used the term in his dissent, magnificent isolation. I think if that is in fact true, that the law of California is decidedly out of the mainstream, that should be a cause for careful reflection and determining, you know, how quickly am I going to simply follow stare decisis. There's also one element, and then I subside, and that is that the activity underway in the now-fabled Pruneyard Shopping Center was, in fact, a government-related activity. It related to our life together as a democracy, whereas the activity here in Fashion Valley was decidedly not. It had nothing to do with our governance. It had to do with a commercial dispute.
Well, based on my panel's comments, I think each of you will have to decide for yourselves whether or not that opinion was founded on the dictates of law. Now, Vicki is going to speak to us about Edwards versus Arthur Anderson.
In that situation, Edwards was an accountant, and when he was hired by Arthur Anderson, he had to sign a non-competition agreement. He worked for Anderson for a number of years and was moving up in the company, and then Anderson, oops, went down during Enron. So Anderson sold the group that Edwards was in to another company, but those Anderson employees couldn't work for this other company unless Anderson was willing to let its employees out of the non-competition agreement. So did Anderson just say, fine, sure? Nope. Anderson said, we'll terminate the non-competition agreement only if you, the employee, agree to release any and all rights that you have against Anderson. Well, Edwards was not very happy about this because he was worried about releasing his indemnification rights, and these were important to him for two reasons. The government was investigating Anderson, and who knows what it was going to cost him to defend himself. And also, there were probably former clients out there who were going to be suing Anderson and name him. So the context in which this case arrived at our Supreme Court was Edwards wanted to pursue a tort claim against Anderson for intentional interference with prospective business advantage. And one of the elements of this tort requires a wrongful act. So had Anderson done anything wrong? There were two possibilities. First, the non-competition agreement. Business and Profession Code section provides that an employer cannot by contract restrain a former employee from engaging in the profession, trade, or business, with a few exceptions that weren't applicable here. That was actually the non-controversial part of the opinion. Everyone in the court agreed the non-competition agreement was totally, completely invalid, and employees have a robust right to mobility. The part of the opinion is very long and very detailed and very scholarly because the Ninth Circuit had apparently rewritten our statute to permit some narrow restraints on it. So our Supreme Court carefully explained no. The more interesting aspect of the case, I think, and which has important implications for the future, involves the competing ways that the court evaluated the release of any and all claims. There are labor code statutes which prohibit any waiver of an employee's indemnity rights. And the majority in the dissenting opinions both agreed that former Anderson employees, whether they signed the agreement or whether they didn't, there was just no way they were releasing any of their indemnity rights. But where the majority in the dissent parted company was why hadn't there been a waiver and what consequences should flow from this. And they viewed the question through very different lenses, which I think can give us a lens for viewing the future. The majority opinion started by applying the general principles that want to make contracts lawful. So as a result, they interpreted this second agreement. Anderson wasn't even trying to include a release of the employee's indemnity rights, so Anderson had not done anything wrong, and that was the end of it. The dissent said, and not in these words, of course, not so fast. Let's look at some other language, and perhaps this language in the agreement that Anderson had written was written to purport to release these unreleasable indemnity rights. So Anderson said, oh, but we didn't do anything wrong because the statute automatically implies an exception and the indemnity rights were not released. Well, the dissent was not buying this because it reasoned, perhaps Anderson had drafted the agreement in such a way that all these employees signing the agreement so they could go to work for the other company would think they had released their indemnity rights. And in fact, that's what the Court of Appeal had thought in the case, too. Well, if Anderson had done something like this, that was a wrongful act, because most employees are simply going to think that a contract written by their employer is totally, completely okay, and it wouldn't even cross their minds to pursue these unwaivable indemnity rights. So it had been wrong for Anderson to set up this kind of situation, and Edwards should have been able to pursue a tort action. So what this kind of says to me is, in terms of the two ways of looking at the world, is that one way is to sort of take at face value how a business claims that it is conducting its affairs, and the other way can be to delve beneath the surface to kind of look closely for hidden agendas.
Well, thank you. Dean Starr, would you like to make a comment about that case?
I think I'm going to pass on this case.
All right. And Professor Ullman, would you like to make a comment?
I just wanted to offer one brief reflection. As Vicki was talking about this problem of mobility of former employees, it occurred to me what an incredible problem we're facing with the mobility of lawyers as we see the huge number of layoffs of associates of large law firms, and those lawyers start looking for other employment opportunities and discover that those opportunities may be severely limited by the potential conflicts of the exposure to the work they were engaged in previously. In many cases, this is handled by a waiver. The client waives the conflict. It's going to be interesting to watch. It's a serious problem, I think, that the bar is going to be facing.
Well, I'll make a comment as well. That case was 5-2 on the point that Ms. DeGoff was talking about, and I joined Justice Kennard's concurrence on that release of all claims. The comment I'd like to make is, and both this case and Fashion Valley Mall, although we would wish and hope that all the opinions were unanimous, and indeed the California Supreme Court, has a very high percentage of opinions that are unanimous. I think Professor Ullman, who was a court watcher, will tell us that we rise to the 75-80%. But the value of separate opinions, I mean, you want it to be unanimous, but a separate opinion, whether it's a concurrence or a dissent, makes the reader and lawyers down the road and future courts think something to choose from. And also, I think it strengthens the majority opinion, because if the majority has had to address on paper, published, opposing views, the majority has to give its very best shot and be forthcoming about the problems with any analysis. So that's my comment on those two cases, and it will apply down the line, especially with our last cases that we're going to be discussing. But now,
just point out with regard to dissent on the court, I do track each year the total dissent rate, which is the number of dissenting votes as a proportion of all votes that were cast that year. And the dissent rate on the California Supreme Court is now at the lowest point it has been in over 30 years. It's about 5.3%.
That's because we're so stable and so wise with all those years of working together. Professor Ullman, you're now going to speak to us about RICO versus Mitsubishi.
Yes, and I'll try to do so very briefly so we can get to the main event here. The role of the California Supreme Court in defining the standards of conduct for California attorneys has diminished somewhat since the establishment of the state bar court. The California Business and Professions Code still requires that the rules of professional conduct be approved by the Supreme Court, and the court still has discretion to review a disciplinary order of the state bar court, but rarely does so. And that means that the court's day-to-day role in setting and maintaining ethical standards for the legal profession will largely occur in cases in which a lawyer's conduct has become an issue in a case, such as a disqualification motion, a malpractice claim, or in criminal cases, a claim of prosecutorial misconduct or defense lawyer incompetence. RICO versus Mitsubishi Motors presented the problem of the inadvertent disclosure of privileged information. And this arose on a motion for disqualification of a lawyer. What should happen, for example, when a paralegal mistakenly includes opposing counsel in the distribution of a privileged email discussing litigation strategy? RICO is a classic example of what should not happen. Plaintiff's counsel walks out of a deposition with 12 pages of defense counsel's notes summarizing a six-hour strategy session with his client, Mitsubishi Motors, discussing the strategy and vulnerability in defending a vehicle rollover case. He admits that within minutes he realized it contained information about the case that the defense did not intend to disclose. He makes copies, distributes them to co-counsel, uses them to strategize his own case and to cross-examine defense experts. The trial court concludes that the notes were protected by the work product privilege, that plaintiff's counsel's use of the notes was unethical, and plaintiff's counsel should be disqualified from further proceedings in the case. The Court of Appeals affirms, and in a unanimous opinion authored by Justice Carol Corrigan, the California Supreme Court affirms and does us all a service by clearly spelling out what should happen when privileged information is inadvertently disclosed. The standard that the court established in RICO was taken directly from a 1999 opinion of the Second District Court of Appeal, Division 4, so with attribution, of course, so Presiding Justice Chuck Vogel, who authored that opinion, should get the credit he deserves. What's interesting is in that case, State Fund versus WCS, the court actually reversed the imposition of sanctions on the offending lawyer because his conduct did not violate any existing decision, statute, or rule of professional conduct applicable in California. To remedy that problem, the Court of Appeals articulated a prospective standard to govern the conduct of California lawyers. I think the most significant import of the RICO ruling is the apparent concession that a division of the Court of Appeal does have authority to set a statewide standard of professional conduct. The decision says, we conclude under the authority of State Fund versus WPS, the Court of Appeal opinion, that an attorney in these circumstances may not read a document any more closely than is necessary to ascertain that it is privileged. Once it becomes apparent that the content is privileged, counsel must immediately notify opposing counsel and try to resolve the situation. And the opinion concludes the existing state fund rule, existing rule established by the Court of Appeal, is a fair and reasonable approach. So the message for California lawyers seems to be, if you are searching for guidance on the applicable standards of professional conduct for your behavior, don't confine your search to opinions of the California Supreme Court. You need to look at what the courts of appeal have to say about it as well. My question is, what happens to the lawyer who has been disqualified? Is that the only consequence that should flow from this kind of unethical conduct? I was pleased that in the opinion, the court identified the offending lawyer. I think the offending lawyer deserves even more. I think he should be disciplined by the state bar. The California Commission on the Fair Administration of Justice, which I recently served as executive director, recently took a hard look at every reported decision in California for a 10-year period in which a finding of prosecutorial misconduct or defense incompetence had been made by a court. Most opinions, we discovered, don't identify the offending lawyer, so we undertook research to go back to the record and find out who the heck all these lawyers were whose conduct had been found to violate the rules of conduct. And we succeeded. We were able to identify the lawyer in 347 out of 443 cases. We discovered 30 of them were repeat offenders engaging in misconduct in more than one of the reported cases. We then took our list to the state bar to determine if any of these lawyers had ever been disciplined. And we learned that no one had ever filed a complaint with the state bar, including the 54 cases where a conviction had been reversed and there was a statutory requirement that the judge notify the state bar. I think this is pretty clear evidence that we have a broken system. The commission recommended a change in the canons of judicial ethics to require judges to report egregious misconduct to the state bar, whether it results in a reversal of the judgment or not. And I hope the Judicial Council will take a serious look at this recommendation.
Well, thank you for that report and those very interesting remarks about attorneys who do find their names, or don't find their names, but should, for violating ethical precepts. Do either of my panel members want to comment? Do you?
I do have a few just very short points that I thought RICO provided a very important reminder of how attorneys are supposed to conduct their professional lives, and that the zealous representation of one's client's interest cannot and should not and does not trump ethical imperatives, and that the attorneys have to honor interests of other attorneys, of the judiciary, and of the administration of justice. I also thought it was very interesting in terms of where the duty is imposed as a practical matter, because modern technology has made it so that mistakes during discovery have become quite common, and attorneys are often providing privileged or confidential material to the other side by accident. And the Supreme Court wisely recognized that if that took away the privilege, then that was going to make discovery much more expensive and cumbersome. And so it didn't want that, and it imposed duties, ethical duties, on the recipient of the privileged material. There's also a slight lesson here, I think, for trial attorneys receiving discovery, and that is, don't just automatically send the material on to the client before you have reviewed it. Because in this situation, the clients had not seen the materials. And as I recall, not only was the attorney disqualified, but all the experts were disqualified as well. And so who knows what would happen if the clients had seen this material. Finally, it brings up for me just kind of another concern, and that is the concern that has to do with privileges and kind of ties in with what Jeff said earlier about a trial is the search for the truth. Well, it is certainly possible that some kinds of privileges and confidential merit, confidentiality can have the effect of concealing the truth. And in civil litigation, this sometimes has the possibility of allowing the more powerful entity to hide information that not only would be useful in the litigation, but could also be useful to society as well to have that out. So while I think RICO is absolutely right about how attorneys should behave, it might actually be time for the legislature to consider the whole concept of how maybe some kinds of things should be reined in, because privileges may be being used for purposes that was not their original intent.
Let me say, Ms. DeGolf's comments were very appropriate. The attorney, I think his name was Johnson, the attorney in question tried to defend himself by saying, well, but I was disclosing perjury and fraud in the deposition of opposing parties' experts. That's what these notes gave me to understand, that when they came forward and were actually deposed, the experts were perjuring themselves. Well, going back to Mr. Goff's comments, that seems like a worthy use, but it won't fly. So now we are going to move on to the very, very interesting, just like all the preceding cases, the very, very interesting discussion about In re marriage cases. And Mr. Goff and Dean Starr together are going to discuss that, including also the North Coast Women's Care Medical Group case. And Dean Starr is going to start out telling us about In re marriage cases.
We didn't quite achieve unanimity on this one. This is not Silicon Valley Taxpayers Association or RICO. And perhaps one of the reasons was set forth in footnote 10 of Chief Justice George's opinion. For the majority, the court has benefited from 45 amicus briefs in the case. Full disclosure, I filed one of those briefs, and I found that the position that I espoused fell one vote short. So you can now take that into account as you assess my comments. Few issues in this decade have been as contentious or have so arrested the attention of the general public as same-sex marriage, so much so that it really has become the defining social issue of our time. In In re marriage cases decided on May 15, we all know is not only the biggest blockbuster of this court's term, but it really perhaps may be the most important decision handed down in the United States by any court. Obviously, it has spawned a political discussion, indeed battle, and new litigation, which would be prudent for me not to note. And so suffice it to say that for purposes of these reflections, I will be looking in the rearview mirror at what the court has done, and how it came to its judgment, the disagreement that infected the court's deliberations, but understandably so. But we will do so consistent with the quiet decorum of a seat of learning, consistent with the kind of deliberative process that goes on inside courthouses. and far removed from the rancor of the streets. One of the enduring jurisprudential lessons of in re marriage cases is the overarching issue of the standard of review. Con law students learn that in their first or second year of law school. And professors are known to depart from the Socratic method to say, this is really important. The standard of review is really, really important. Now, we saw this just a few moments ago in the Silicon Valley taxpayers case. The people, through the political process, said, in effect, to the judiciary, as now interpreted by our unanimous Supreme Court, we would like, thank you very much, more muscular judicial review. And it might very well be said, and a lesson newly learned in in re marriage cases, that where you start in the analysis will likely determine where you end up in terms of the result. Now, famously, the four-member majority chose very carefully, very deliberately, strict scrutiny as the operative standard. And as justices of the Supreme Court of the United States have noted, that strict scrutiny may be strict in theory, but it is almost always fatal in fact. There's been one exception that comes to mind in the years of Supreme Court of the United States jurisprudence, the exception that proves the rule. Laws do not pass strict scrutiny as a general matter. The basis of this dispositively influential choice of standard of review by the distinguished majority was a path-breaking determination that sexual orientation, like race and gender, is a suspect classification. This is a constitutional landmark for the country. It had been reached by various judges and justices singly in courts across the country, and by one intermediate appellate court in Oregon, but this was the first in the United States by a court at the most senior level. Now, the court had had before it an opportunity and invitation to steer a middle course, not to go all the way, as it were, down the standard of review ladder to rational basis, but to embrace the argument of the Attorney General of California that the court adopt an intermediate level of scrutiny. And I love to quote the court itself. Here's the language of the court in respectfully turning aside the Attorney General Brown's submission in this important respect. Unlike decisions applying the federal Equal Protection Clause, California cases continue to review under strict scrutiny rather than intermediate scrutiny those statutes that impose differential treatment on the basis of sex or gender. Because sexual orientation, like gender, race, or religion, is a characteristic that frequently has been the basis for biased and improperly stereotypical treatment, and that generally bears no relation to the individual's ability to perform or to contribute to society, it is appropriate for courts to evaluate with great care and with considerable skepticism any statute that embodies such a classification. And so here it is. The strict scrutiny standard, therefore, is applicable to statutes that impose differential treatment on the basis of sexual orientation. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court was not willing to go that far, but did, of course, reach the same result, but through a different avenue. The reason for this result, it seems to me, from the opinion as a whole, and it is very detailed and it's very impressive, was the overarching value of equality and dignity and human freedom. Different sections of the majority opinion lift up these overarching values, and then the judicial role in giving meaning to those soaring concepts. We've also heard it from Ms. DeGoff in earlier context in our conversation this morning about the role of the courts in protecting minorities and especially those who have perhaps found themselves disenfranchised and powerless. And it seems to me that that's what the case came down to and what divided the court. The majority acknowledged that tradition was and is important, and so was and is the role of the people in self-governance. But values of equality and dignity and liberty swept aside or trumped those values and concerns, legitimate though they might be. That is, the practical experience of the people, the importance of the fundamental right in human existence to marry. This language from Chief Justice George's opinion makes the point very eloquently. One of the core elements of the fundamental right to marry is the right of same-sex couples to have their official family relationship accorded the same dignity, respect, and stature as that accorded to all other officially recognized family arrangements. The current statutes, and there was a very careful parsing of the law of California, including the more recent changes in the law. By drawing a distinction between the name assigned to the family relationship available to opposite-sex couples and the name assigned to the family relationship available to same-sex couples, and by reserving the historic and highly respected designation of marriage exclusively to opposite-sex couples, while offering same-sex couples only the new and unfamiliar designation of domestic partnership, pose a serious risk of denying the official family relationship of same-sex couples the equal dignity and respect that is, and here I think is key language, a core element of the constitutional right to marry. Now, the jurisprudential basis for recognizing same-sex marriage is, of course, profoundly important. One ground, of course, is liberty in the sense of individual autonomy. But I note that if expansively interpreted, and this, of course, was abundantly before the court, and it took note of this, could usher in less conventional social arrangements. The court handled this in a single footnote, footnote 52, of unconventional social arrangements. What is intriguing in the court's response in footnote 52 is that the court chose there overtly to look to culture. And I think that bears repeating. Culture, indeed the language of the opinion, the nation's culture. Culture condemned unorthodox arrangements, such as plural arrangements, as inimical to vital values of family stability. That is, I'm interpolating just a bit here, healthy families were seen as a culturally sanctioned value that trumped what are at least presently viewed as idiosyncratic arrangements that might emerge from a robustly libertarian framework. So I think it's important for us to, in reflecting on what the court has done and how it has done it, to look at footnote 52 and to reflect on footnote 52. Now, the Attorney General of the United of California. I don't think the Attorney General of the United States was involved in this. Made the argument in his brief that all of the same legal benefits, along with judicial interpretations, were afforded same-sex couples. But again, I return to where I began. Dignity, equality, these carried the day. In addition to its footnote 52 and its reliance there on cultural understandings to reject the idea of less orthodox marital arrangements, the court also recognized what now does exist, leaving Prop 8 and all that stuff aside, because the court recognized, as it was required to do, the now two-track nature of the marriage definition in our state, That is, of course, for many purposes, not for all by any means, federal law likewise speaks to the definitional question. And thus, the proverbial elephant in the room was not Prop 8 and its future, but that federal law put in place a decade ago. And now whether federal law will be changed by virtue of what I assume will be the democratic process as opposed to judicial interpretation. And that brings me to the dissents. There were two. Justice Baxter, joined by Justice Ming and Justice Corrigan. Justice Baxter spoke in strong language that this is a matter very sensitive and trusted to the democratic process, and that the traditional definition embraced by the people of California was consistent with express national policy created by a decidedly bipartisan national legislature and signed into law by a president of the same party as our president-elect. That the tradition was supported by a universal tradition, by a convincing popular vote in this state, by dispositively influential federal authority, and thus embracing a very different standard of review, the lowest standard of review of rational basis. The opinion emphasizes democratic theory and democratic governance, the people participating in the conversation. The language is strong, an exercise in legal jiu-jitsu seriously oversteps the judicial power, a cataclysmic transformation of this venerable institution. On a jurisprudential note, there was dissent with respect to what should, in fact, enjoy the status of suspect classification. And canvassing briefly the decisional law, Justice Baxter, joined by Justice Ming, suggested that insularity and relative political powerlessness have, in their view, been seen as quite important in determining whether a particular person or a particular community does indeed trigger the kinds of concerns that Ms. DeGoff emphasized in her earlier comments. And he said, making a political statement, that the gay and lesbian community has enjoyed, quote, a political emergence that is particularly apparent. Justice Corrigan, as I close in my report, four votes on this court should not disturb the balance reached by the democratic process, a balance that is still being tested in the political arena. And she lifted up a lamentation about what she called the broken covenant, the covenant between the judiciary and the people.
Ms. DeGoff, do you want to speak to that?
Thank you. As academics, judicial officers, government attorneys, advocates, and students, we tend to look at decisions from perspectives that focus on legal doctrines, and we think about how they develop legal principles or how we can use the decision, say, in a case that we're working on. But there's another way to look at some of the most important decisions, and this is where a court has been called upon to get involved in how society functions. No constitutional principle is written in the sky, and some of them are not even written in the law books. They live in our hearts, and they live in our minds. Once separate and equal was okay, and then it wasn't. Once racially diverse marriages were not okay, and then they were. What I think is key to the marriage cases is the majority's recognition of the psychological and the social importance of being able to be married to one's heartfelt love. While I'm slightly paraphrasing, this is pretty close to what the majority said in a number of places, and while I wouldn't ordinarily read, I'm going to read because it's important for the key point that I want to make. Marriage can be crucial to an individual's development as a person and an individual's achievement of his full potential as a human being. The opportunity to publicly and officially express one's love for and one's long-term commitment to another person is an important element of self-expression that can give special meaning to a person's life. A marriage is the basic family unit for an adult. Being able to enter into an officially recognized family relationship provides an opportunity to become part of the spouse's family, and this in turn can provide a vital network of economic and emotional security. The right to marry, the right and the opportunity to marry, is fundamental and of central importance to an individual's opportunity to live a happy, meaningful, and satisfying life as a full member of society. Now, if one starts from that perspective, you can only end up at one place. The Constitution prohibits depriving a class of individuals of these crucial rights simply because of their sexual orientation. Everyone has the right to choose one's life partner, and everyone has the right to enter into what the court described as a committed, officially recognized, and protected family relationship that has the same dignity, respect, and stature as the officially recognized family relationship of marriage. And the court explained why it simply doesn't work to call this relationship a domestic partnership. Historically, there has been disparagement of gay persons, and domestic partnership, there's too grave a danger, will turn into a mark of second-class citizenship. But if one starts by looking elsewhere, then one ups being somewhere else, and so it is with the dissents. The dissents view marriage as an institution in history, rather than looking at the impact that marriage has right now on individual people's lives. And historically, marriage has always joined a man and a woman, and based on this premise, that any profound change in this ancient social institution has to come from the majority of the people through the ballot box. And to me, this, again, is interesting because of the essential difference in ways of looking at the same situation. My understanding is that I should now go on to North Coast.
We're going to let Professor Ullman later. Speak to the marriage cases, and Ms. DeGolf now is going to very briefly tell us about the North Coast Women's Care Medical Group case, and just briefly, because I know, and I think perhaps some of you might want to be writing questions. I don't know how much time we'll have for questions. Anyway, go on to North Coast Women's Care, and then Professor Ullman can chime in.
This case presents an interesting variation on the interface between constitutional law and discrimination based on sexual orientation. Because instead of using the Constitution to prevent discrimination, what the defendant wanted to do was to use the Constitution to justify discrimination. And she wanted to get out of obeying a law by relying on her constitutional rights of religious freedom and free speech. Under the facts, a woman was being treated for infertility at a medical group because she'd been having difficulty getting pregnant. When it came time to do a certain procedure, her doctor said no, and the plaintiff alleged it was because that she was a lesbian. And the plaintiff then sued under the UNRUH Civil Rights Act, and it entitles everyone to full and equal services in all business establishments without discrimination based on many factors, including sexual orientation. Now, the first sentence in the majority opinion describes the issue as whether the constitutional rights of religious freedom and free speech exempt medical clinic physicians from complying with California's prohibitions against discrimination under the UNRUH Act. And the second sentence says the answer is an unequivocal no. So this looks like a pretty far-reaching holding. But the court's reasoning and other statements actually end up in making the opinion quite narrow. So in the interest of time, I'm not going to tell you the technical legal way that that happened, but what I am going to do is just cut to the chase, and the chase is, what does this full and equal access without discrimination mean? And what it means is all that a physician in a group medical practice has to do is to refer the patient to another doctor in the practice who will perform the procedure. So the physician doesn't have to perform the procedure, and the physician's religious beliefs are totally, completely honored. The concurring opinion puts a spotlight on how, in some sense, limited the opinion is. And it points out that the court has not expressed any view on how the UNRRA Act would be applied to a doctor who was a sole practitioner. And it reasons that such a doctor, if such a doctor could refer a patient with relative ease and convenience to a doctor in another practice, it would seem that making the original objecting doctor liable for violating the UNRRA Act would not be the least restrictive way to further the state's legitimate interest in under the UNRRA Act of making sure that everyone has full access to all services. So where does that leave us? And I think in some sense where it leaves us is that perception sometimes has a greater effect than reality. Because the big statement at the beginning of the opinion is where a lot of people stop reading. And that lot of people appears to be the press and the general public. So it is entirely possible that the very existence of the opinion may end up moving society a bit further than its legal technicalities would require.
Vicki, I'm shocked. I'm shocked. I thought everybody read every word of our opinions, including our concurrences and our dissents and our concurrences and dissents. But I think Professor Ullman has probably been restraining himself very politely to comment, as is his due now, on the marriage cases and perhaps North Coast women.
I do have a few brief words.
And perhaps questions could be collected at this time so that if there are questions, excuse me, Jerry, if there are questions, I can address them immediately after Professor Ullman stops.
I think the school of jurisprudence reflected in the majority opinion in the marriage cases is what I like to call the fenestrationist school of jurisprudence. These are judges who look out the window before they render a decision. And I think the view from the Supreme Court's windows, looking down at City Hall and seeing the line of people lined up to get marriage licenses, might have had some effect. The fenestrationist school, I think, is represented by Brown versus Board of Education. I think it's represented by the Perez miscegenation cases. School of jurisprudence is, of course, the defenestrationists. Those are judges who jump out the window. I found in remarriage cases to be a very persuasive opinion, and I think it will have persuasive power that will certainly survive whatever happens in the wake of Prop 8. In fact, it already has. The Supreme Court of Connecticut cited and relied on in remarriage cases and noted that it was a very persuasive opinion in putting Connecticut in the column of states that now recognize gay marriage. I found Justice Corrigan's reference to a covenant of judicial restraint fascinating. I've never seen it expressed quite that way. And in a way, it disturbs me if judges are subscribing to some sort of covenant beyond the oath that they take to support and defend the Constitution. I don't think that requires adherence to any particular judicial philosophy or school of jurisprudence. It requires simply following your conscience in terms of what the Constitution demands. Finally, I do want to comment on what I think is a real irony. Clearly, the court went out on a limb in remarriage cases, and I think the question now is going to be whether the voters sawed off the limb when they enacted Prop 8. But there's an irony here, because the argument being made with regard to in-marriage cases or with regard to Prop 8 is that Prop 8 is a revision of the Constitution. And the irony for me is that if it's a revision of the Constitution to overrule and abrogate in-remarriage cases, then by definition was not in-remarriage cases a revision of the Constitution. And I don't think the court's going to be ready to admit that they have the authority to revise the Constitution.
You have heard some very, very provocative comments and about our opinions in remarriage cases, and the opinions are all eloquent and well-reasoned, and I really, for those of you who would ever have the time, would urge you to read all of them. And they to bring our panel to a close, in remarriage cases, in my judgment, really raises the question that Governor Wilson left us with, that courts should follow the dictates of the law. You read all the opinions in that case, and you will again have to decide for yourself where, in the context of the marriage cases, where lies the dictates of the law. Clearly, there were several different points of view on that, all well expressed and firmly believed as a matter of legal analysis. So I hope one day you will have the opportunity. You've heard a lot of the major points from my wonderful panel, and I thank my panel very much. You've been terrific.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.